Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Boy of Blackstock by Alice Askew and Claude Askew. Have interesting case on hand. If nothing better to do, join me tomorrow, Headstone, Essex. Such was the wording of a telegram which I received at the little French watering place where I happened to be staying, from Almer Vance, whom I imagined to be somewhere in Syria, busy with the exploration of certain ancient ruins. It was autumn, and I, for my part, was getting tired of a rather purposeless continental ramble, so I hailed Vance's telegram with joy. I cabled back that I was coming at once, caught a night boat from Dieppe, spent an hour or two in London, and arrived at Headstone Grange, my friend's house in Essex, in time for lunch. He would not say a word about the case. However, until we had disposed of that meal and were lazily indulging in dessert, for himself he ate very little but fruit and vegetables at any time. Cereal will keep till later on, he observed then. I decided to go, and ran down to Headstone to get a few things together. And then I received a visit from a certain gentleman, and, well, it promised to be interesting, so I sent you that cable. He interrupted my expression of pleasure that he had done so by asking a question. Do you know the meaning of the term poltergeist, Dexter? He inquired. I had heard the expression. Isn't it a German word that expresses a sort of mischievous ghost? I replied, an elemental spirit that pulls furniture about, rings bells, smashes crockery, and makes itself generally obnoxious. Is that the kind of thing that we've to deal with this time? Almer smiled. Perhaps, he responded with his usual caution. But there are circumstances about this poltergeist, if the term is at all relevant, that lifts it above the common. The ghost of Blackstock Priory, where we are invited to go tomorrow, is really a family specter, and it bears a name that is traditional, the Mischievous Boy of Blackstock. You may have heard of it, for the old legend is well known. It belongs to the Rystone family. Lord Rystone owns Blackstock Priory to this day, though the possession was once very bitterly disputed. I have an idea that I've heard the story I put in here, but I should like you to refresh my memory. The tradition goes back to the Stuart times, resumed Vance, and of course, there is a tragedy connected with it. The Lord Rystone of that day happened to have a very beautiful young wife, of whom he was immensely proud, and at the same time, inordinately jealous, probably with good reason, for she appears to have been as frivolous as she was beautiful. Anyhow, the story goes that one day he surprised his wife, under compromising conditions, in the company of a certain handsome young fellow named Gregory Laidlaw, who was the son of the very man who disputed Lord Rystone's title to the property of Blackstock. Well, the husband's jealousy and wrath got the better of him, and he murdered them both upon the spot. Murdered them in cold blood just where he had found them, in a certain room at the Blackstock Priory, which, at that time, was his wife's boudoir. He then reported what he had done, and, in the result, was acquitted, or received no punishment worth speaking about. But he wasn't let off so easily by his victim, Gregory Laidlaw. Lord Rystone continued to live at Blackstock, which, by the way, is in Essex, and at no great distance from here, but his life was made a burden for him. The mischievous boy soon began his pranks. I take it that the term boy has been applied to Gregory Laidlaw, or rather, to Gregory Laidlaw's ghost, more on account of the monkey tricks that he perpetrated than because of his actual age. According to the story, he must have been at least 23 or 24 when he was murdered. Anyway, he gave Lord Rystone no peace, never making himself actually visible, but playing the most ridiculous pranks at inopportune times, throwing open doors, wailing and laughing about the quarters, pealing the bells, and often frightening people out of their wits by touching them with his cold, clammy hands. Well, this went on for months and months, until one day Lord Rhystone did actually see his enemy. Something, heaven knows what, took him to the room where the tragedy had been enacted. He said he obeyed an impulse that he couldn't resist, and there he saw both his victims and Gregory, his hand upon his heart and a derisive smile upon his lips, bowed to him three times. A few days later, Lord Rhystone died. After that, Master Gregory played no more pranks, unless his room, the scene of his murder, was interfered with, which it was by several subsequent Lord Rhystones. People who were given that room to sleep in were frightened out of their wits. Their bedclothes were pulled off them, or they were jerked about in the most uncomfortable fashion. But the boy himself was not seen. He appeared only once to each Lord Rhystone in succession, and that was as a foreteller of death. At last, the Rhystones became sick of their ancestral ghost and let the priory on a 99-year lease to the then representative of the Laidlaw family, which was really as it should be, for the Laidlaws were the first owners of the property which they had been unfairly jostled out of. They were Essex people, which the Rhystones were not, and had always been popular in the country. As soon as Mr. Laidlaw came into possession, he had the haunted room shut up, and from that day on nothing whatever was heard of the mischievous boy. Elmer Vance paused and carefully peeled the skin from an apple to which he had just helped himself. Having consumed the fruit, he resumed. The lease granted to the Laidlaws has now expired, and the present Lord Rhystone, who appears to be a man of obstinate and cantankerous temper, has refused to renew it. He has in fact elected to go and live at Blackstock himself. And the mischievous boy has broken out again, I hazarded, and is giving him a warm time of it? That is so, Elmer smiled his slow smile. Lord Rhystone refused, however, to believe that there is any truth in the old tradition, and maintains that he is being made the victim of a conspiracy. He suspects some agent of his late tenants to be at the bottom of the whole thing, for the Laidlaws want to get back to Blackstock, and the people of the neighborhood want nothing so much as to see them reinstated. In spite of this belief, he has come to me, which proves that there is some latent superstition about him, though he won't admit it. Or, of course, I ventured, there may be some other natural cause for what is going on. I know that this sort of thing is usually associated with a human object, some hysterical individual affected perhaps by the old tradition. Doesn't the poltergeist usually act through a human medium? You have told me of such cases. There was Halton Manor, for instance. Do you know anything of Lord Rhystone's family? Vance nodded appreciatively. He liked me to show an intelligent interest in his cases. I know very little further at present, he responded. Lord Rhystone was not very communicative. It appears that he has been in residence at Blackstock for about a month, and I imagine that there is no one in the family except himself, his wife, his two boys, and their tutor. The boys are his sons by his first wife, for you may remember that it is only a couple of years since he married for the second time. His wife is ever so much younger than himself, and she was, I believe, the daughter of a clergyman, quite a poor man, who is now the vicar of Blackstock. These things I know from hearsay, local gossip. I've met the vicar. His name is Gaynor, the Reverend Allison Gaynor, at some county function. An able man, from all accounts, and one who is ambitious for higher things. Of course, he obtained his present living through the influence of his son-in-law. But for the moment, all this is outside the question. The point we have to solve is whether the manifestations of Blackstock are of human or superhuman origin. And we'll get to work tomorrow. I mentioned that I proposed to bring a friend with me, so you are expected. The next day, accordingly, we proceeded by car to Blackstock Priory, which is situated to the northeast of the county, a lonely and rather uninviting spot, not far away from the sea. We arrived in the course of the afternoon and found the whole household together, with one or two visitors in the garden partaking of tea under a huge oak tree that was still leafy in spite of its great age. Lord Rhystone came forward to receive us, and I was formally introduced. The man's appearance did not impress me favorably. I could readily understand why Vance had described him as an obstinate, pig-headed man. He had a square jaw and an ugly mouth that had a way of twisting sarcastically when he spoke. One could imagine him capable of saying most unpleasant things upon the slightest provocation. He had black hair and black bushy eyebrows, which came close together over the bridge of his nose. I put him down as being about 50 years of age, perhaps a little more. His voice was loud and raucous. "Glad to know you, Mr. Dexter," he said, "and I hope you and Mr. Vance will find means to put an end to this infernal nuisance that I've got to submit to in this house. Of course, I don't believe for a moment that it's anything to do with spooks, and the story of the mischievous boy is nothing but a silly superstition. No, sir, I don't believe in spooks. And I can tell you straight away that I suspect my servants. There are people about the place who have a spite against me, and who want nothing better than to turn me out. They think they can frighten me away, but that's where they are mistaken. I'm not the kind of man to give in when I've made up my mind about a thing." It wasn't the time to argue the point, so I merely made some commonplace observation, after which I was introduced to the rest of the company. Naturally, my interest at that moment was centered upon Lady Rhystone. She was charmingly pretty, after a delicate Dresden china sort of style. She could not have been much over 20, very fair, and with tiny little hands and feet. She had eyes and lips that seemed made for love and laughter, and pretty dimples in her cheeks. But looking at her closely, one felt painfully that all these charming attributes were gradually fading, and that it would not be long before the piquant little face became pinched and fretful. It was obvious, even to the casual observer, that she was not happy. What on earth had induced her to marry Lord Rhystone? That was the first thought that shot into my brain on seeing her. Then I remembered that she was the daughter of a poor clergyman, and that probably family interest had been the chief factor in the case. I felt sorry for her, for certainly she must be paying heavily for her sacrifice. Lord Rhystone's two sons, boys of 12 and 14 years of age, were present with her tutor, whose name was James Felton. The boys were dark-haired, heavy-jowled young cubs, who had never been to school in their lives, and whose manners were atrocious. Nor did I like the appearance of the tutor. He, too, seemed to absorb some of the prevailing gloom. He was a good-looking young man, but he had a discontented mouth and eyes that seemed to be shifty and untrustworthy. The rest of the party consisted of the vicar, Lady Rhystone's father, who seemed pleased to renew his acquaintance with Vance. He was a handsome man with intelligent, well-cut features, but somehow looked no happier than the rest, and I fancied that he often glanced uneasily at his daughter. Besides him, there was a couple of callers, a dull man, and his even duller wife. They left soon after we arrived. After their departure, conversation turned on the supposed haunting, and Lord Rhystone repeated the story of the mischievous boy, the story with which I was already acquainted. "There has never been a hint of a ghost at the Priory for the last 100 years," he said. "In looking up the records, the last allusion I can find to the boy is when he appeared to my great-grandfather, sometime in the 19th century, just before he died. That, of course, was years before the Priory was leased to the Laidlaws. The superstition is, you must understand, that the boy only shows himself when one of our family is going to die. Otherwise, he is never visible, nor does he get up to his tricks, unless the room in which he and his lady love were murdered is interfered with. That's the yarn they tell." "And you have opened up that room?" inquired Vance, who had settled himself comfortably in a deck chair. "Yes, and why not, I should like to know," retorted Lord Rhystone, with some asperity. "It's one of the finest rooms in the house, and situated in a part of the building where it can't be easily dispensed with. It's ridiculous that it should be shut up forever on account of an old wife's tale. I'm furnishing it as a bedroom, and eventually I shall sleep there myself." He spoke the last words defiantly. "You have the courage of your opinions," replied Vance quietly. "But if you desire peace, might it not be just as well to try the effect of closing the room again as an experiment?" "No," was the abrupt and rather surly response. "I've told you that I don't believe there's anything supernormal in the whole business. It's all a got-up job by someone who wants me to leave the place altogether. If you can prove to me the contrary, Mr. Vance, then I'll shut up the room, but not until then." While this conversation was in progress, a conversation in which I took no part, I was watching the faces of the rest of the company, and I could not help imagining that the tutor, Mr. Felton, kept his dark eyes fixed upon the face of Lady Rhystone. and that she was uncomfortably aware of the fact. And I imagined that there was something malignant in his regard, almost a threat, and that he wished to convey the fact to her. The moment, however, that he noticed that I was looking at him, he turned his attentions to his pupils, to whom he made some half-laughing remark. As for the two boys, they seemed to take the whole thing in the light of a joke, and I could see them giggling together, although they were evidently in some awe of their father. They were ill-conditioned and badly brought up youngsters, and it naturally occurred to me that they might have something to do with the manifestations, if these really had a human origin. Anyway, I decided to keep my eyes upon them. "May I ask," inquired Vance, addressing our host, "if you opened up the haunted room as soon as you came into residence at the Priory?" Lord Rhystone shook his head. "No," he replied. "It wasn't until a fortnight later." "And did you have any trouble during the first fortnight?" The answer, rather grudgingly delivered, was again in the negative. "But it was only after I'd been here a fortnight," added his lordship, "that the neighborhood began to show me that I wasn't wanted. I'd taken on some of the old servants, keepers and others, who had been in the employ of my predecessors. They were a lazy lot, and I told them so. The Laidlaws have always been notorious fools in their treatment of their people, and I suppose the fellows didn't like the new administration. Anyway, they all gave notice in a body, and it was after that that the trouble began." "I see." Almer sat back in his chair pensively, and for a while after that took no part in the general conversation. One of the boys, the eldest, was recounting how he had been told that morning that one of the servants, happening to pass the door of the haunted room rather late the night before, had heard curious sounds from within, and being braver than most of his fellows, had ventured very gingerly to open the door. It was not quite dark within because the moon was shining, and the room, as yet only half furnished, had not been provided with curtains, and the man declared that he caught sight of what he imagined to be two dim figures standing in the moonlight, apparently clasped in each other's arms. He was not, however, able to swear positively to anything, because before he had time to open the door wide, it was torn from his hand and then slammed violently in his face. Lord Rhystone frowned heavily. Incredulous though he professed to be, he was palpably worried at this suggestion of the actual appearance of the boy, an appearance reputed to bode ill. "Who told you this absurd story, Paul?" he asked gruffly. "It was Lomax, the underfootman," responded the boy readily. "Very well, go and tell Lomax that I want to speak to him at once. We may as well question him here in your presence, Mr. Vance." Lord Rhystone addressed the last words to my friend, who quietly nodded his acquiescence. And so Paul ran off, evidently delighted with his mission, and a few minutes later returned with the underfootman, who, in our presence, confirmed in every respect the story which we had just heard, adding one or two details of his own. He had imagined that he heard voices in the room, low whisperings, and it was that which had at first attracted his attention, knowing as he did that the room was not yet in use, and that in any case nobody was likely to be there at that hour of the night. He told his story gravely, palpably convinced of the truth of every word he said. He seemed to me a well-spoken, dependable sort of young man, and I felt genuinely sorry for him when Lord Rhystone, unable to shake his story in any particular, lost his temper, addressed him roughly and told him that he was a coward and a fool. "Why on earth didn't you open the door again after it had been slammed in your face?" shouted the angry Earl. "I suppose you were too frightened to do so?" "I did try," responded the young man, flushing to his hair, "but it was no use. The door was locked." "Well, that's a proof that you're telling a lie," was the fierce retort, "for there's been no key fitted to the lock yet." He turned to Vance and myself. "The room has been walled up," he explained, "and after I had it opened up, we found an unlocked door without a key. And as I haven't gotten a new one yet, how was it possible that the door could be locked? The fellow's a palpable liar." The natural consequence of this repeated assertion was that the footman gave notice upon the spot, and I may say that I thoroughly sympathized with him under the circumstances. Lord Rhystone fumed with rage. He swore violently without the smallest regard to the presence of his wife and children. "It's a conspiracy," he declared, "and they are all in it, but I'll get even with him yet." Soon after this, we went into the house, and Vance and I were left to ourselves till dinner time. During this interview, I took the opportunity of mentioning to him the curious expression which I had seen upon the tutor's face and the significant glance which he had cast at Lady Rhystone. "I don't like the look of that fellow," I said. "But of course, it may only have been my imagination. Have you formed any opinion so far?" "It's much too early yet to form my opinion," was my friend's reply. He smiled a little. "You ought to know by now, Dexter," he said, "that I never jump to conclusions." At dinner that evening, we were introduced to yet another member of the household, Mrs. Mellish, who acted as companion to the young countess. She was an elderly and austere woman who did not in the least add to the gaiety of the company. And it was while we were at dinner that we were treated to our first manifestation of the mischievous influence that was at work in the house. There came a tremendous crash all of a sudden in the hall without, and on running to the door, we discovered the butler standing in the midst of a debris of broken plates and dishes and other paraphernalia that he'd been carrying to the dining room upon a tray. He was white and trembling, and he had cut his hand a little. Lord Rhystone's cheeks grew florid with rage, and he began to bluster. He had never known such gross carelessness in his life, he declared. What on earth had the man done to drop the tray? The butler stooped and picked up something from the floor, where it lay among the fragments of broken china. "That's what did it, your lordship," he said nervously, holding up for our inspection a heavy flint stone. "It fell down from overhead, right into the middle of my tray. I couldn't help dropping the thing. No one could have." The hall was large and square, and a gallery round three sides of it. It would have been quite easy, I reflected, for anyone concealed up there to drop the stone as the butler passed below. But the incident made one thing practically certain. If someone of the house party was responsible for the trouble, there must undoubtedly be a confederate as well, for we had all, including the two boys, been assembled at the dinner table. The boys rushed off upstairs, and for the next few minutes, while their father blustered, we could hear them careering up and down the gallery and opening every available door in their pursuit of the ghost. But their efforts were quite futile. Presently they returned, excited and looking upon the whole thing as excellent sport. I was soon to find out that they behaved in exactly the same way after every manifestation of which they were witness. The butler was still quaking, partly from fear and partly with wrath, at the way his explanation had been received. "I can't stand it any longer," he muttered, staunching the blood from a small cut upon his hand. He looked almost as if he were about to faint. "I'm sorry, my lord, but I should like to leave tomorrow, if you will allow me." "Yes, go and the devil take you," roared his lordship furiously, after which we all returned to the dining room and continued our interrupted meal as best we could. Nothing further occurred till about an hour later, when we were assembled in the drawing room, except the two boys who had been sent off to bed. The first intimation we had of the return of the poltergeist, if poltergeist it was the sudden opening of the drawing room door. It was flung violently back, so violently as nearly to throw it off its hinges. At the same moment, I distinctly heard the sound of a chuckling laugh. Yet, once again, when we rushed out into the hall, it was to find no trace of any living soul. Almost immediately afterwards, however, and while we were still standing there, literally gaping at each other, a series of bells began to ring, apparently from somewhere in the servants' quarters. Poor Lady Rhystone was nearly in tears, to all appearance, terribly afraid. "Oh, Kelsey," she entreated her husband, "what's the use of going on like this? Why won't you shut up the haunted room again? Or, better still, why won't you leave this horrid place altogether? I dare say you'd like me to take you away, wouldn't you?" he retorted in a tone that to me sounded quite unnecessarily brutal. "But I've had enough of London, and so have you, for some time to come. And as for shutting up the haunted room, I am damned if I do. I'll get to the bottom of this infernal conspiracy first." There was something terrifying in the frown he bestowed upon his wife, and Lady Rhystone seemed to shrink under it. Her lips quivered pitifully, and she shook in every limb. I felt more sorry for her than ever, and deeply incensed against the man for his sheer brutality. I was puzzled, too, for at the same moment I was again conscious of that queer, menacing look in the tutor's eyes as he watched the scene. There was something horribly exultant about it. I think that is the word that most clearly expresses my meaning. Well, We had no more alarms that night, and the next day Vance and I set about making a thorough exploration of the priory, which I don't think I've mentioned was a low-built, rambling edifice with walls of considerable thickness. I suspected secret chambers and passages, and indeed, several of these were known and pointed out to us by Lord Rhystone. For the most part, however, they had been blocked up so efficiently as to render them impossible as hiding places. We examined the haunted room. It was a large, low apartment upon the first floor. After its use as a boudoir by the murdered Lady Rhystone, it had been used as a bedroom, and then dismantled because of the hauntings. It was at present unfurnished save for a few old-fashioned chairs and a sofa. It had a painted ceiling, and its walls were hung with faded tapestry. There were one or two curtain recesses which added to the eerie aspect of the room. "With your permission, Lord Rhystone," said Vance, "I will pass the night in this room. You need not worry about the bed. I shall be quite comfortable in one of the chairs." Permission was granted, and then, very naturally, I asked Vance to allow me to share his vigil. But to my surprise, and a little to my mortification, he refused. He laid his hand in a friendly manner upon my shoulder. "Don't be vexed, Dexter," he said. "I have my reasons. Believe me, it is for the best." He would not give his reasons, and I knew him well enough by now to appreciate that argument was useless, so I was forced to accept the inevitable. Well, I had thought out all manner of plans for trapping the ghost if the ghost should prove to be human. Thread entanglements over the bell wires and that sort of thing, but Vance would have none of them. "Wait till tomorrow," he said. "I shall know better then how to act." I could not induce him to tell me his suspicions, yet I knew they were already forming in his mind. At dinner that night, there was another unpleasant scene, not due this time to ghostly phenomena. Lord Rhystone came impalpably in a bad temper. He attacked his wife almost before a particle of food had passed his lips. "Your father's been to see me privately this afternoon, Elsa. Do you know why?" It was his tone rather than what he had said that implied wrath. She looked up eagerly, I thought. "No, Kelsey, what was it?" "He's giving up his living, the living he begged me for and which I gave him. He's quite independent of me now, if you please. They want him in a large London parish, and I suppose we shall hear of him being made a bishop next. Not a word of gratitude. A wretched, penniless curate, whom I set on his feet because I happened to take a fancy to his daughter. He fawned about my neck as long as there was anything to be got out of me. But now I may go hang." He muttered other things, which were only half audible, luckily. I watched Lady Rhystone and wondered at the joy which I read in her eyes. Joy which her disconcerted air at this public outbreak could not quite conceal. She made no retort, carefully avoiding to say a word which might still further incense her husband, and as soon as possible turned the conversation into a safer channel. But I think that Vance, like myself, noticed her flushed cheeks and eager expression. We had very little in the way of phenomena that evening, and at 10 o'clock we parted for the night. Vance went to the haunted rooms, and I saw him no more till the morning. He came to me quite early, before I was up, and sat on the edge of my bed. "Dexter," he said gravely, "we have got to give up this job. It isn't in our line. I wish we could leave today, but there are people asked to meet us at dinner. However, tomorrow..." I sat up in my bed in my surprise. "Vance," I exclaimed, "have you solved the mystery?" He inclined his head. His face was more than usually serious. "Yes," he said. "Won't you tell me?" "When we get home. Not now. There's still some work that you and I must do, and it is no pleasant task. But this I want to ask you. Don't trouble me with questions till we are clear of the Blackstock Priory." I promised that I would not, but needless to say, I was puzzled to a degree. However, as fate would have it, the day did not pass without my making a discovery on my own account. It happened in the course of the afternoon. Vance had gone out on some errand with which he had not acquainted me, and I was amusing myself with a book in the garden. It was a hot day, and I had found a comfortable nook, screened by trees, close to a little glade where there was a marble seat, probably a trophy carried off from some ancient Italian palace. I must have dropped off to sleep, for I can only remember starting up at the sound of voices in the glade, from which I was completely hidden. A woman was speaking. I recognized the voice of Lady Rhystone. You are an unutterable blackguard. That is what I heard her say, a loathsome blackmailer. But you daren't do what you threaten. Why not? The answer came in the suave, displeasing voice of Felton, the tutor. Because, however much you might hurt me, my husband would thrash you as you deserve. That may be. The man gave an ugly laugh. Nevertheless, my lady, I refuse to abate one jot of my demand. 1,000 pounds. And I know you've got the money, that you've been saving up for contingencies, pawning your jewels. You could give me that sum without hurting yourself. Come, be sensible. His voice had a persuasive note in it now. I don't want to hurt you, but I'm hard up, desperate, like yourself. I want to get away from this accursed place and from those two unlicked cubs I'm supposed to look after. And I can only do it by putting pressure upon you. Now that I've found you out, think of the scandal, my lady. It became known that the mischievous boy of Blackstock, he laughed again, is no other than your lover. In order to avoid whom your husband took you away from London, because he had begun to have his suspicions. Supposing Lord Rhystone knew, as I know, that this man can get in and out of the Priory as he pleases by means of a secret passage opening into the so-called haunted room. That as long as the haunted room was shut off, you're both quite happy, since you, my lady, had secret access to it as well. But when it was opened up, your trysting place was no longer safe. So you had to have recourse to the old superstition in order to frighten his lordship into walling it off again. Or better still, to compel him to leave the Priory altogether. Supposing all this were known, what then? My horror at hearing this cold-blooded revelation may be imagined. I hate to think that, all unwittingly, I have been an eavesdropper. From the first, it was impossible for me to reveal myself. It might only have made matters worse, and I could not steal away without betraying my presence. So this was the pitiful explanation of the mystery. This was what Vance, too, had found out and refused to tell me. I could understand his reluctance now. It was all I could do to restrain myself from springing out of my hiding place and laying violent hands upon the vile blackmailer. Every nerve in my body tingled with a desire to pay him in different coin to what he demanded, but I kept myself in control. And of the rest of that abominable interview, I need record no more than this. Felton accorded his victim a period of 24 hours in which to make up her mind. Unless he received his pound of flesh upon the following day, he would unfailingly betray Lady Rhystone to her husband. I waited impatiently for Vance's return, and when late that afternoon we met, I told him everything. He was deeply concerned, for of this troubling, threatening Lady Rhystone he was quite unaware. 24 hours, Grace, he muttered. This is serious, Dexter, very serious, for I can foresee what will happen. Lady Rhystone and her lover, for it's true about the lover, unfortunately true, will act at once. Tonight, instead of waiting till tomorrow, as they proposed. He told me of his experiences the night before. I had my suspicions, he said. You see, I had a chat with Gaynor in the garden the day we arrived. The vicar confided to me that his daughter was unhappy, that she was being treated like a prisoner, always watched except when she was in the house. That unpleasant woman, Mrs. Mellish, you know, she was too fond of gaiety, and there was a man who was fond of her. A man named Frank Prescott. Anyway, Lord Rhystone became jealous and carried her off to Blackstock, and Mr. Gaynor blamed himself bitterly. You see, it was in his account that his daughter married, in order that he might get the living and the benefits. Well, these things made me suspicious, and I formed my own conclusions, too, by studying Lady Rhystone's face. I arranged to spend the night in the haunted room. I found a secret passage, as I had expected. It leads to a ruined chapel just outside the big wall, and it communicates with another room in the house, an empty one, as well as with a haunted room. So you see, while the latter was shut up, two people could meet there practically with impunity. It was less safe afterwards, as we know from the experience of Lomax, the underfootman. It is evident in that case that the lovers had secured the key and were able to save themselves by using it. And later that night I saw them. Yes, Dexter, the lovers met, and never dreamed that they were watched from behind one of those curtain recesses. No one knew I was spending a night in the haunted room, so they had no suspicions. They were only together for a few minutes, and it was to plan an elopement. Not for tonight, because there were preparations to be made, but for tomorrow. Lady Rhystone considered herself free at last. She had borne all the indignities that her husband heaped upon her, because her father had been dependent upon Lord Rhystone. But now, you noticed her hardly concealed joy at dinner when she heard that Gaynor had secured his independence. She was free to do what she liked, so she declared, and her husband had long ago forfeited by his brutality all right to her love. It appears he had struck her over and over again. And so, everything was settled between them. Tomorrow night, they would fly together and brave the world. But now, Dexter, I foresee that they will change their plans. They will go tonight. I admitted the force of this reasoning. What is to be done? I asked. I saw Gaynor this afternoon, resumed Vance, and told him everything. His sympathies are wholly with his daughter, but he naturally wishes to save her from taking a false step. We had arranged that he should come tomorrow morning and take her away. Rhystone cannot keep her in the Priory by force. And now, well, there is nothing for it but for me to return to the vicarage and warn Gaynor of what has happened. He must act at once, dinner party or no dinner party. He must come to the Priory this very evening, see Lady Rhystone, and persuade her to go away with him. That is the only practical course. And this was the plan upon which we decided. Vance set off at once, and he did not return till near the dinner hour. But he had failed in his mission, for the vicar was away from home, and all efforts to find him had proved unavailing. That hateful dinner party, how well I remember it. The whole company seemed to be on tenterhooks, and when about 10 o'clock Lady Rhystone pleaded a bad headache, Vance and I glanced meaningly but helplessly at each other. Luckily, the guests departed soon after that, and we men, with the exception of the tutor, who had pleaded some excuse, retired to Lord Rhystone's study to smoke. Half an hour later, there came a horrible interruption. The door flung open, and Felton, excited and disheveled, rushed in. "I've come to warn you, my lord," he cried. He gazed at us defiantly. "I consider it my duty to do so. Your wife has introduced her lover into your house. It is he who is the author of the disturbances, which have only been contrived in order that they may continue a guilty intrigue without interruption. They are now..." I was boiling over with rage. "This man is a vile blackmailer," I began, but Lord Rhystone silenced me with a gesture. He had risen, and his face was congested with rage. "Go on, Felton," he said hoarsely. "Where are they now?" "In the haunted room. If you hurry, you will find them there together. They are eloping tonight." He gnashed his teeth with the wrath of a blackmailer foiled. Lord Rhystone did not speak another word. He jerked open a door of his desk, extracted something which he held under his hand, and then, without a glance at any of us, made for the door. He was across the hall and mounting the stairs before we had time to realize the full horror of the situation. "Quick! He's got a revolver," cried Vance. He set off in pursuit, followed by myself and then by the tutor, who had turned deathly white and staggered as he went. But Lord Rhystone was fleeter than any of us. He had thrown open the door of the haunted room before any of us could come up with him. I heard him mutter a hoarse cry. Then he lifted his hand and fired. The shot echoed horribly down the corridor. The next moment Lord Rhystone repeated his cry, but this time it was a scream of fear. He fired again wildly, and then, throwing up his arm, staggered back. Vance caught him as he fell. And I, for a brief moment, I was able to see through the open door into the haunted room, and I was dimly conscious of a figure, that of a young man clad in garments of a bygone day, who stood smiling and bowing towards Lord Rhystone, his hand upon his heart. The mischievous boy of Blackstock had fulfilled his destiny. Lord Rhystone died a few days later of a stroke of apoplexy, so the doctors declared, and it was not many weeks later that Lady Rhystone was quietly married.